the web at born.com.
6 minutes past 11 o'clock. Good morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Acton. Glad you could join us. 538 Americans, otherwise known as presidential electors, are meeting at state capitals today to officially elect the next president of the United States. The outcome is no mystery, barring a real shocker. Texas Governor George W. Bush will win just enough electoral votes to win the White House. And in theory, that should be it. The election that would never end will finally be over. But there are still lots of loose ends to tie up, wounds to heal, lessons to learn. And, of course, there is the future to consider. What happens now? Joining us today to share his wisdom on where we've been and, perhaps more importantly, where we're headed is former Vice President, former Minnesota Senator, and former U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Walter Mondale. As always, we invite you to join our conversation as well. If you have a question for Mr. Mondale about the election past or the administration ahead, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Mr. Mondale, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. Glad to be here on this beautiful winter day.
Now, you were involved in a fairly close election in 1976, but goodness, nothing like this.
No, we had no recounts. We had an edge in the electoral vote as of 2 o'clock election morning. And it's much different than now. We had statistically even, and we ended up, as we all know, with this once-in-a-lifetime's experience.
Why do you suppose the election was so close?
You know, I don't know, but that's a very good question, because I have never seen the nation split right down the middle like it is now. The Senate is 50-50, but I've never seen that. The House is just about 50-50. The popular vote was 50-50. The electoral vote, if it reflected popular vote, would be 50-50. And then I'm told, if you look at the popular vote for the United States Senate nationally, how did it break down? And for the House, you end up the public actually voted 50-50, and that somewhat the same breakdown if you look at legislative votes. So what is the public saying? That they're perfectly happy and keep it the way it is, that they're suspicious of politicians, therefore always check them, or is there some other message there that we better be aware of, that they want people to work together and so on?
I can't let you get away without commenting on the Electoral College, since today is Electoral College vote. Is that a good system to hang on to, or should we change it in some way?
Well, first of all, it was a mistake. When our founders shaped this country, the thing they didn't want was factions or political parties. They thought that would ruin the country. They wanted to have a nation that would be thinking only about picking the next George Washington. So they set up these board of electors, and each state was supposed to select their most distinguished citizens. And they would then go down to Washington, make up a board of electors, and they would pick the next George Washington. Mm-hmm. Well, it never worked that way. Immediately, we slipped into political parties, to partisanship, and now the electors are basically elected and pledged to one candidate or another. So it's a system that never worked the way it was supposed to. The other thing, should we change it? Well, it's going to be hard to do, first of all, because the smaller states, like Wyoming, Utah, and so on, maybe even Minnesota, are going to say, look, if we just have population in the election of a president, these presidents are going to spend all their time in New York and California in the great metropolitan population center, and they're going to ignore us. At least under this system, they've got to come and pay some attention to us. Another argument, as bad as this recount was, how would you like to have a national recount with us only, say, 500 votes apart. So there's a lot of questions here. One thing for sure is that we need electoral reform. We can't go through what we went through this time. We need balance, election machine systems, recount systems that bring us a lot closer to fully reflecting the vote and doing so in a sound way. Today, it's a mess.
Were people always aware of how messed up the system is and they just chose not to pay any attention to it?
Here's one who wasn't aware of it. I ran for office most of my life. I never heard of the punch card ballot problem. What this recount did is focused attention on a problem that the experts have known existed for a long time, and that is that we've got about one-third of the American people cast ballots on a punch ballot system, which is old technology, very unreliable, many rejected voters, old, feeble, and the rest have trouble dealing with it. And it, in some precincts, over 20% of the votes are rejected. I ran into the chairman of the Hennepin County Board the other day, who told me that about 8 years ago, their people told him that these punch card ballot system that we then had was very unreliable. And so they moved ahead and got the optical scanners, very expensive, very controversial. But they said it was clear here in this community that the system wasn't working. So this is a issue that is now national. We got to correct it.
Looking ahead now, George W. Bush is the president-elect, and presumably today the votes will be cast to officially make him president. How daunting is the task that he faces now in terms of trying to put together a government, especially in such a short time frame?
Well, I think he's gotten off to a good start. Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice are good selections, indeed very distinguished. But it is daunting. He doesn't have a lot of time to do it in, and he's never been in national office himself before. We've had the system in America where you elect governors as presidents, and they come to Washington, and they've had no experience on national security issues, foreign policy issues, managing a national economy, the Federal Reserve Board, and the rest, and they've never dealt with the Congress. And usually the governors believe that this Congress is just like their state legislatures, when in fact it's quite a different animal. And they come down to Washington, they become president, and they have to learn all of these things very quickly, because all of these institutions and our friends and our enemies around the world are testing them. It's a very tough and perilous time when you have a new on-the-job president, training president.
Does it matter a lot if the president doesn't know this, assuming he or she eventually surrounds themselves with really top-flight advisors?
Well, you have to do that, and he's gotten off to a good start. There's no question that you need people that have been around the block. The problem is that you can't delegate a lot of things that a president must do. And secondly, your advisors disagree. And the tougher the issue gets, the more you have disagreement, the more someone has to be in there deciding and calling the direction in which the government goes. And I've been through many, many times as vice president, sitting around the cabinet table, when the poor president is sitting there with all of his advisors disagreeing with each other over bitter issues. Hmm. So a president, as I mentioned the other night, there's a reason why presidents always seem to age 10 years and 4 years. This job is a crusher, and you can't avoid a lot of this responsibility. You can get help with able people, but finally you got to do most of the tough lifting yourself. That's why Truman had that sign on his desk, "The buck stops here."
Mm-hmm. Why would anybody want to be president, given that reality?
Oh, this is the greatest country on earth, and to have a chance to lead it is about as high an honor you can possibly imagine.
But what a crushing responsibility.
Oh, it is. And part of the toughness is that you get pushed hard when you're green, I mean, everybody's testing you. Everybody in Congress is trying to measure you. Our adversaries around the world are cooking up things right now. And our friends are trying to figure out a way to get to us. The governors around the nation are planning some things. And all of this, they want to get in to influence the new administration while it's setting policy. So this is going to be a challenge for the new president. We wish him well. He is our president. That's an important thing to say here. But it is always a tough time for a new president.
One last question for you, Mr. Mondale, before we get to some callers here. Both, the two high-profile appointments that President-elect Bush has made, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, both of whom have indicated over time that they are pretty reluctant to send U.S. forces hither and yon unless there is a clear, demonstrable national interest at stake. Quite a different approach, really, than what we've seen in the last 8 years. How is that going to change the U.S. position in the world, do you think?
Well, first of all, I think they're both good choices. I know both of them, and I'm impressed by them. It is true that Colin Powell has frequently said that we shouldn't get involved in any kind of effort involving military, American military forces, unless we go in with full power and are sure to win. And I think that's, generally speaking, a very good formula. Condoleezza Rice and the others have said we should stay out of some of these more complex and ambiguous situations like Bosnia and Kosovo and so on. My personal belief is that these issues will not be as easy to handle once they're in office as they are in a campaign. These paradoxes have a way of surrounding you and making things much more complicated and more difficult to answer. If we had stayed out of Bosnia and Kosovo, if we hadn't gotten involved in Europe with the Europeans to settle that, one of the worst monsters in the world, Mr. Milosevic, would be continuing his ethnic genocide, and I don't think we could stand for that. So I think that they will be confronted with difficult, ambiguous situations, which will cause them to have to adjust.
Former Vice President, former Minnesota Senator, former U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Walter Mondale is our guest this hour, talking about, to some degree, the election that we've, I think, now completed, but looking ahead, too, to some of the big challenges facing the new Bush administration. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Jan, you're first. Oh, go ahead.
May I just say one thing? He's also a little lucky here because there's no big crisis right now in the world. The economy's in pretty good shape. There's a surplus in the federal budget, so he doesn't confront a really crushing problem right out front. So he may have a little more time here to adjust.
Mm-hmm. Jan, you're first. Your question for Mr. Mondale, please.
Yes, I have a three-part question. First, I'm very pleased to be able to speak to you, Mr. Mondale.
Thank you very much.
First of all, I'd like to hear a little bit about specifically what does the Vice President do? What are his responsibilities? What does he do from day to day? Secondly, how has that changed, if it has changed, over time? I'd heard that Al Gore had kind of expanded the responsibilities of Vice President. And thirdly, what do you suppose we will see from Dick Cheney in this regard?
Good graduate school political science question there. Well, the role of the vice president has evolved in recent years. It used to be, as Nelson Rockefeller called it, standby equipment, or John Nance Gardner called it, not worth a pail of cold spit.
Elegant phrase.
Yeah, right. from Uvalde, Texas. It's changed. The vice president is much more deeply involved in the administration. Carter, for the first time, put his vice president in the White House. I was there. I was involved in almost everything we did for 4 years. I saw every piece of information that the president saw. I had unlimited access to him at any time, and I think we set a new institutional precedent for future vice presidents, which have been followed since then. The role of each vice president will be different. It depends essentially on what the president wants him to do or will let the vice president do. But that has changed considerably. And I think people have looked more seriously at who they select as vice president than they once did as a result. A vice president has very few formal legal duties. One is he presides over the Senate and he can break ties. That happens about once each year. He is a member of the National Security Council, but the biggest part of a vice president's function is what I mentioned earlier, this broad range of informal tasks that are conducted by the vice president at the request of the president. Cheney will bring certain strengths to the vice presidency. He was Secretary of Defense. He did serve in the House. That gives him some understanding, experience on the Hill in defense and military matters. He will come at it with a lot of background. Both he and Colin Powell, incidentally, have that kind of background. I think he will be heavily involved in political advice to the new president, who's had no federal experience. And so I would guess, based on what I've seen thus far, he's going to be a fairly influential and strong vice president.
Now, you said traditionally the vice president is called on to preside over the Senate, cast
right.
that tie-breaking vote only usually once a year.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Senate tied 50-50, might we expect that to come up more often?
It could be. The vice president only breaks a tie when he wants to. In other words, it's not just when there's a tie vote that the vice president votes. It's only when there's a tie vote and his vote will win the result that he wants. So I think when I was vice president, I only cast one tie vote. Maybe it's two, I forget. But it doesn't happen very often.
Tie generally would defeat a bill.
Well, there's a lot of ties that are not very important, and it can be resolved in other ways. But in this Senate, which is unbelievably 50 senators on each side, it could well be that he's going to spend a lot of time in that presiding officer's chair and may have a lot of reasons to vote.
Is it realistic for the Democrats in the Senate to say, well, gosh, we're tied here, we should have... you ought to be sharing power with us, Republicans. Is that realistic, or doesn't one of the parties have to be pretty much firmly in control to get anything done in the Senate?
Well, why did the public vote for 50 of one and 50 of the other? In other words, if they wanted a majority, they could have elected a majority. They know all about this. They didn't do it. So you have, that's why I started the program by saying the public is telling us something. It may be that they just want us to sit down and resolve these issues across party lines and stop squabbling. And what better way of forcing it than to say each side gets the same number of marbles, and you've got to play this game. If that's what is wanted, I think that new ways of getting compromise are needed. If the Republicans say, well, we're going to act as the majority, because we, as one of them put it, you have to have a majority, and they said, we're going to have the same advantages that we had when we had a real majority. In other words, the majority leader will control the agenda on the Senate floor. The majority leader will determine who's sitting in the vice president's seat when the vice president's gone. The Senate committees will have ratios that give a majority to the Republican on each committee rather than equal numbers, and the chairman of each committee will be a Republican, and the control over the rules on the Senate floor and in the committees will be entirely under the control as though we were the majority, and the staff allocations on the Senate staff and on these committee staffs, which are a big thing, will be entirely loaded in favor of the party that just broke even. I mean, there's got to be some bending here, it seems to me, and I'm told that Daschle and Trent Lott have been talking about some kind of resolution of this. But I don't think you can just go whistling by this problem and pretend that you don't have a unique situation here that requires some kind of different resolution.
Skip, your question for Mr. Mondale, please.
Yes, sir. It seems that a lot of people are saying that the Nader vote and other votes took votes off the top, which helped cause the tie. And I'm wondering if the instant runoff wouldn't be the simplest change to our electoral system that would affect the fewest people, and probably when somebody was allowed to vote for one and two, that tie would probably go away when the lower number of votes were added to the higher number of votes.
When we get into the issue, as I hope we will, right up front here, of electoral reform, I imagine that alternative methods for dispute resolution of the kind that you're suggesting will be considered. I think the priority in this study, however, ought to be to get uniform national balloting systems and procedures that prevent the nightmare that we've just gone through. There are much better systems around, usually found in upper-income parts of the country, because most of these costs are local costs. So the communities that can afford them get the benefit of modern technology with scanners or with what they call touchscreen systems that work very well. There's very few rejected ballots. If you make a mistake, it tells you you've made a mistake and you can correct it. It is in the poorer areas, not entirely, but one-third of America now casts on these old, unreliable systems. So that's got to be the first thing we deal with. I am not, how should I put it? I'm skeptical of changing the current idea of basically majority or plurality rule, because it's a system that forces Americans to go to the center. The radicals on either side have a hard time controlling and influencing our country today than they would under a system where we diluted the decisiveness of a majority or a plurality in America. Many countries have plurality systems, and I think they're less stable than we are. There's a lot of frustration among different minority points of view in America. That's what we saw with Buchanan, that's what we saw with Nader, but I think the country as vast as ours, despite those frustrations, our system has worked well, and we've been able to get reform such as civil rights and the rest through this system. So I'm a little, I haven't really looked at that, to be honest with you, but I'm a little skeptical of it.
Let's get one more caller on here before we break for news. Dalal, your question, please.
Yes, my question for Mr. Mondale is, what if the economy slipped into a recession? What will the new president-elect do about it? Especially because he's a Republican and not a Democrat.
Well, this would be a problem that could be really tough for him and for all of us and for the Congress, because instead of having all this good news we've lived with in recent years of being able to consider tax cuts, fund things that need funding rather easily, pay off the debt, and all these good options, the president would have all those options in the reverse. Rising deficits, disappearing revenues, recession-related expenses like unemployment and so on, lost revenues from that, causing new pressure. There's a lot of budgetary implications to a recession that could be very tough for everyone.
And would President-elect Bush be held responsible, do you suppose? Let's say we get into, April, and things really have gotten kind of nasty. Will people automatically blame him because he happens to be the president at that time?
Oh, there'll be a big debate about who did this. What I found in my years in the White House, which I think every president has found, I was the vice president, but I saw what was happening, is that presidents usually get most of the credit for good news and all of the credit for bad news, despite their efforts to argue differently.
Walter Mondale is our guest this hour, former vice president, former Minnesota senator, former U.S. ambassador to Japan, joining us this hour to share his thoughts on the election that is now coming to an end and what challenges face the Bush administration. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to more of your calls here in just a couple of minutes.
Hello, I'm Bill Kling, president of Minnesota Public Radio. Your response during our recent membership drive was very strong, and the result is that we're on track thus far to have a balanced budget for the year. Some of you who called made it clear that you could do more and that you'd like to know more about long-term support of Minnesota Public Radio. This is a good time of year to consider gifts of appreciated stock. Taking a deduction for a stock gift to MPR can be a very effective strategy. You can join the builders of MPR who have made the major gifts that have helped us grow to the level of service that we now provide and make sure that that service continues to grow and improve in the future. If you're interested in restricting a major gift for a special project, we'd be happy to visit about that. And if you'd like more information about making a stock gift, particularly before the end of the tax year, please call Katie at 651-290-1216 or visit our website at minnesotapublicradio.org. Again, thanks for partnering with us to make great radio.
And just to reiterate, as you consider year-end tax planning, we hope you think about a contribution to Minnesota Public Radio. Call 1-800-227-2811 for more information. News headlines now. Here's Stephen John. Stephen?
Thank you, Gary. The state that found itself at the center of the presidential election fight, Florida, has officially cast its 25 electoral votes for George W. Bush today. Cooperation is the theme being sounded today on Capitol Hill, where President-elect Bush has met with Democratic and Republican leaders of the House and Senate. House Democratic leader Dick Gephardt promised to meet the Republicans at least halfway. The president-elect is still standing firm on his plans for a $1.3 trillion tax cut. He met this morning with Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, who's voiced concern about the size of that cut, but Bush won't give any details about what Greenspan may have said on that subject today. Stock prices are mostly higher on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 200 points. Blue chip stocks are higher on optimism that interest rates could soon be lowered. In regional news, a Canadian Pacific Railway train carrying molten sulfur derailed this morning in Plymouth. A railway spokesperson says 27 cars of the 102-car freight train are on their sides following the derailment around 7 this morning. The railroad says some of the sulfur is leaking, but doesn't pose a threat because of the cold weather. No evacuation was required, and the two-person crew was not injured. The cause of the derailment hasn't been determined. Authorities say it could be days before a storm sewer in Rochester is completely cleaned after a gasoline leak near the Assisi Heights Convent in Rochester. Nearly 800 gallons of gasoline spilled into the nearby storm sewer yesterday after a convent employee noticed a gas pump was on. A second winter storm in 3 days has slowed traffic to a crawl and has disrupted school schedules across southern Minnesota. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning for southeastern Minnesota, where total snowfalls could reach 8 inches by tonight. Much of the area has already gotten 3 to 5 inches of snow, and snow could accumulate at a rate of half an inch per hour. Snow and 3 degrees in the Twin Cities. That's a news update, Gary, from Minnesota Public Radio.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. 25 minutes before noon. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio, and our guest this hour, former vice president, former Minnesota senator, and former U.S. ambassador to Japan, Walter Mondale, joining us this hour to talk about some of the challenges facing the incoming Bush administration. Today, the electors are casting their ballots. And, again, as we noted at the beginning of the program, barring some complete shock, by the end of the day, Mr. Bush will have accumulated enough electoral votes to be the next president of the United States. I'm wondering, Mr. Mondale, in terms we've heard a lot about, well, now he's coming in, he's made such a point about trying to work with Democrats, bipartisanship, and the rest. Is that actually going to play out, do you suppose, or as soon as... the rubber hits the road here, why all talk of sweetness and light will go out the window and kind of back to...
Well, you know, I haven't been running for office myself for some time, but I'm told by friends of mine who are that they get a lot of citizens who tell them that they expect the two parties to work together in a more mature, productive way, and that that is a not an insignificant factor in American politics today. If that's true, and it may well be, the American people are going to be looking at both parties to see whether they try to reach toward the middle and get these things done. And I think the first party that appears to have stepped across the line may be in for a surprise. Having said so, I think that would be that both parties be well advised to try that that approach. The president-elect has repeatedly said in the campaign that he wants to reach across boundaries, and if he will do that, I think it'll help him and he'll find support. But this is more than saying hello to people and meeting with people. He's doing the right thing today. He's meeting with President Clinton and with Vice President Gore. He met with Greenspan yesterday. He's met with the congressional leaderships. Leadership will do that again. That is all important and crucial, and I applaud him for that. But there's another element to this that we don't know yet, and that is, will his policies be shaped to bring people together? If the answer to that is yes, then I think this thing can work. But it's there where we do not know yet. He's been calling the last couple of days for this $1.3 trillion tax cut. That's going to trigger a lot of resistance that's not just partisan, but concern expressed by people about what happens to the economy with a deal like this and what happens to the ability of the government to support things like education, Social Security, and so on. So I think he's going to find that he has to take a look at his policies to see that they fit what you might call the middle in American life and in the Congress.
Now, if you're a Republican, though, especially a conservative Republican, and you're looking at this for the first time since 1952, you actually control the White House, the Senate, the House of Representatives. Isn't this the time, as a responsible Republican, to finally push through all the things you've been talking about low these many years? Why should you bend over backward to try to keep the Democrats happy?
Well, first of all, you didn't get a majority for president. You lost that. Secondly, you didn't get control of the Senate. You lost ground in the Senate. You only have half of it. And finally, the American people have voted right down the line. Neither party goes out of here. Sure, they got the White House back, but under the circumstances with which we're all familiar. This is a time when neither side should say, it's ours, I get to have my way. Built into the American system, in the congressional system, all along has been this unique power that rests in the Senate and with each senator to slow down and debate issues and force consensus or compromise. That's true under any government, but with a 50-50 Senate, it's doubly true. And I think that the spirit of what President Bush was saying as he campaigned for president, that he wants to reach across the line, if he will couple moderation in policy with that approach, I think he could get some response. But if they say, no, we got to have our way in all these pent-up issues, we got to have right-wing judges, we're going to roll back the women's choice, we're going to do a lot of these things that they've talked about, I think that we'll have a fight pretty soon.
John, your question, please.
Yes, Mr. Mondale, it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to you and to hear your views.
Thank you.
My questions have to do with the current system of campaign financing.
Right.
As you know, many people, Senator McCain perhaps most prominently, are concerned that the current system elevates special interests above the general interest. And I was interested in your thoughts on this. Specifically, do you think that we do have a serious problem in the country? And if so, should something be done about it? Can something be done about it? And also, I'd like to know how things have changed since your campaigns.
I thank you for that question. I was going to bring that up earlier in the discussion because I feel so deeply about it. I think the role of big money in American politics is beyond a scandal. It's just sinking the system. What is something like $2 billion? I don't know what the figures are this year, but it's turned American public office holders into full-time fundraisers and part-time office holders. Every day we're visited with the spectacle of huge amounts of money, uncontrolled amounts of money from special interests pouring into both political parties, and we got to stop it. And that's what Senator McCain has tried to do. And I admire his leadership so much on this. And he's already said that he intends to raise this issue. If President Bush wanted to really gain the respect of a broad cross-section of Americans, including those who didn't vote for him, I can't think of anything better he could do than to call up his old friend John McCain and ask to join with him, provide presidential leadership to end the expenditure of soft money in the American campaigns, because that's at the heart of this problem. And he would get a lot of support within his own party and within the Democratic Party as well, and the credit would go to Senator John McCain of Arizona.
Larry, your question, please.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. It's nice to hear from, I don't know what to call you now, Mr. Mondale.
That's very good,
years,
thank you.
Many years in public service. I'm sure Hubert Humphrey is very proud of you.
Well,
and how you've grown to be a statesman over the years. Having spent more than 14 years in Asia, in China and Taiwan, I have a slightly different perspective than a lot of people, but one of the major things that people in Asia have said, and people who live outside the United States have said, is that we have a problem with our long-term foreign policy, mostly because at the most every 8 years we're changing presidents, and that has a tendency to throw our foreign policy and our strategies kind of into the wind back and forth. Do you see any way of implementing any type of improved long-term foreign policy between the parties, or possibly in a tripartisan way of having even independents be part of some sort of policy, long-term foreign policy,
okay,
that we might be able to implement?
I think I know what you're talking about. I was just in Asia about 5 weeks ago, and my friends in Japan and some of them in China commented that they didn't hear foreign policy, and certainly Asia or their countries, mentioned much in the national debates or in the campaigns. And, of course, they see themselves as being important players in the world. I think it's there are certain things that help provide the continuity that you're talking about. There's a broad and underappreciated group of career officials in the State Department, in the Defense Department, and in other Treasury Departments, so on, who are specialists in these various areas that you're talking about, who tend to continue on through administrations. And then there's a group of Republicans who over the years have specialized in Asia, just as there is a similar group of Democrats. And they tend to talk to each other. So we'll have Armitage, for example, will be probably in the administration. He's, we all know him well. He knows Japan well. They know him. There are other names that are being suggested for prominent roles in the Asian part of the department, in the State Department, in the National Security Council, over in defense, and so on. So I think that these countries will find people very quickly that they know and understand. And that's one of the reasons that the policy over there has been one of continuity. Each administration changes a little bit, but American policy toward Japan, for example, has been remarkably the same over all of these years.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any real sweeping changes in terms of our role in the world as a result of globalization and the rest? There was a CIA report, or intelligence report issued, I guess it was yesterday or today, indicating that 15 years down the road, they see some pretty substantial changes in how the world will be put together. And or are we going to remain over the next 10, 15, 20 years, kind of extending the policies that we pursued in the last 10, 15, 20 years.
How do you work up questions like that? let me see.
It's a strange mind here.
Yeah. There's no question that there'll be changes. One of the things that people are talking about is the growing severe risk of terrorism. Just what we saw the other day in Yemen when they blew the bottom out of a Navy ship in the harbor, the possibilities of serious, massive human loss from the effects of what will be just a few terrorists, their ability to have transport weapons disguised of mass destruction is increasing. Chemical, biological kinds of terrorist attacks. This is growing all the time, and this may change somewhat the challenges. I think this thing we talked about earlier, the role of Western power in these more ambiguous internal struggles like we saw in Bosnia and Kosovo, even though we'd like to stay out of those things, we should try to stay out of as much of it as we can. I think there'll be more challenges of that kind because the long-term implications of that are dangerous. We've got, where is China going to go? This is a big question. Where will Russia go under Mr. Putin? That's another. There's a lot of big questions around here that will be challenges. The other thing I'd like to say is that while we have a new president, basically, he's populating this administration clearly with old hands that were experienced by virtue of his father's administration. That's what Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Cheney, Card, all these people that we're seeing now we've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the doubt or questions about where we're going to go are almost answered by virtue of that.
Bill, your question, please.
Yes, good morning. My question is a foreign policy question also. You being in Japan, I've wondered in the last few years if do we really need to have our troops stationed on foreign soil? It almost seems heavy-handed 50, 60 years after the war. Couldn't we... I don't want to be an isolationist about it, but it sure seems like we could support them from our side of the ocean. I was curious what your thoughts are.
Well, that's a good question. It gives me a chance to say that I think we do need them there. The Japanese pay more what's called host nation support for our forces there than any other country in the world. It would be more expensive to have our forces in the United States than where they are now. Secondly, the vast distances involved in deployment of American forces is such that unless you have them over there, as we now do in Korea and Japan and Guam and so on, they're really out of position. Right now, there's still risks in Korea. There's risks of those shipping lanes. That region has been historically unstable. I think the United States has a tremendous stake in the economic dimensions there, in the stability dimensions of the region. I think that the U.S.-Japan alliance has contributed a lot to us as well as to Japan and stability in the region. That's not the reason for today's discussion, but I feel very strongly that alliance is in our interest and should be continued. Now, it need maybe be changed. The numbers, the location, all of those things can be changed. But I think the fundamental alliance is in our interest, even though, as you say, it's been a half a century since that war.
Stephanie, your question before we wrap up here?
Oh, thank you very much. It's an honor to speak with you, Vice President Mondale.
Thank you very much.
In fact, when I turned 18, you and Geraldine Ferraro were the first ticket, presidential ticket I got to vote for. So
you sound like a very smart voice.
my question is about this talk of unity and such. Unity actually within the Democratic Party. There was an interesting article in the New York Times yesterday, the Democrats, many seem skeptical of Gore's future, talking about basically how he could have done more and why didn't he do this and get Clinton's help more, and et cetera, et cetera. It seems they interviewed quite a few Democratic Congress people, and it seems like there's a lot of disagreement about where the party is going to go in the future. And one thought I had was, well, can't we just talk about election reform and the disenfranchisement of voters and how the Supreme Court voted, and like put our energies this direction instead of infighting amongst the party? And I was just curious if you've caught wind of some of that.
Yes, I have. I don't know whether it's more than the expected chatter following an election. Speaking as a Democrat, I think we have to be careful about it, because it's clear that we need to be united. We need to move on to the next challenges. And these internal fights, if one would develop, are always at great expense. I was around when Humphrey was defeated for president in a very close election because of internal fights. I remember in 1980 when Carter and I were defeated, and part of it was a lot of doubt among Democrats about us. Maybe well-placed, I don't know. But there's no question that Democrats are gifted at finding ways of fighting with each other. Will Rogers once said, "I don't belong to any organized political party. I'm a Democrat." It's charming, but also very expensive to us.
You think the Supreme Court has been in some way irreparably harmed, at least in the view of Democrats, I guess, based on their decision?
You know, this is very hard for me to talk about. I believe in the importance of the Supreme Court. I accept their decision. They are our final resort. If we didn't have that, how would we resolve some of these most fundamental nation-threatening disputes that come up every once in a while? So I don't want to be heard as not trying to understand this. But having said that, I don't like it. And it's hard for me to talk about it because I am a Democrat. I was for Gore. But what Justice Stevens, a Ford appointee, said, I think has some merit. And I think for a while the court, and because of that, all of us will be struggling with this. We have to accept the decision, and I do. And that is that it made the court appear to be making a political decision. They say they didn't. I will accept that. But there's a lot of Americans that are feel that way, and that is not a very good thing to happen.
And very briefly, sir, do you think Mr. Bush is going to be successful in his effort to, he says he wants to change the tone in Washington, get away from all the nastiness?
If he will change the tone and find policies that permit that change of tone to occur, he could be successful, and we'll all be better off if he is.
So it depends on the policy.
I think so.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your coming in today.
Thank you.
Former Vice President, former Minnesota Senator, former Ambassador to Japan, Walter Mondale, joining us this first hour of our midday program to talk about the election past and the administration future. Thanks to all of you who've been with us this hour, especially those of you who called in or tried to call in with your questions and comments. Just a reminder, over the noon hour, it's off to the National Press Club. We're going to hear today from the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, Bill Ivey. That's at noon. Right now it's 5 minutes before.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 18th of December, 2000. It was on this day in 1972, a string of American B-52 bombers 70 miles long flew over the North Vietnam capital of Hanoi and dropped their payloads on the city. It was called Operation Lineback 2. It was a bombing campaign that went on for 11 days. It's the birthday of Harold Varmus, born in Oceanside, New York, 1939, who, along with J. Michael Bishop, discovered the cancer-causing genes called oncogenes. It had previously been thought that cancerous cells grew because of an invasion from outside the cell, but oncogenes are normal genes that control growth in every living cell and turn cancerous only under certain conditions. It was on this day in 1917 Congress approved the 18th Amendment to the Constitution, which was the first official step toward a nationwide prohibition of the sale of intoxicating liquors. It's the birthday of Fletcher Henderson, born in Cuthbert, Georgia, 1897, went to Atlanta University, moved to New York City to become a chemist, but was hired to play piano on a riverboat on the Hudson River. And a few years later, 1924, he formed the Fletcher Henderson Orchestra. And it was through his innovative arrangements that he shaped a new sound for big band jazz, arrangements that left room for improvised solos between arranged passages and which emphasized the horns. It's the birthday of Ty Cobb, born Tyrus Raymond Cobb in Narrows, Georgia, 1886. He played for the Detroit Tigers, and by the time he retired from baseball in 1928, he had the highest lifetime batting average of any player, .367. It's the birthday of painter Paul Klee, born near Bern, Switzerland, 1879. Went off to Munich, became part of the expressionist movement known as Der Blaue Rider, the Blue Rider group. He made drawings that he described as taking a line for a walk, known for their blocks of color behind spare figures and spidery lines, and his use of a great wide range of materials. And it was on this day in 1860, John Crittenden, Senator John Crittenden from Kentucky, a slave state, proposed a measure that he hoped would forestall the Civil War, the Crittenden Compromise. It proposed that slavery should be protected south of a certain line through the state of Missouri, and that the Congress should not abolish slavery south of that line, and that the federal government would compensate the owners of fugitive slaves. In March of 1861, the Crittenden Compromise was narrowly defeated in the Senate. Crittenden died during the Civil War. His sons were major generals, one for the Union, the other for the Confederacy. Here's a poem for today by William Blake from The Everlasting Gospel. The vision of Christ that thou dost see is my vision's greatest enemy. Thine has a great hook nose like thine, mine has a snub nose like to mine. Thine is the friend of all mankind, mine speaks in parables to the blind. Thine loves the same world that mine hates, thy heaven doors are my hell gates. Socrates taught what Miletus